The following episode of Bookmark was first broadcast January 7th, 2025. Every day, every day, every day, every day I read the book. Chapter 1, you didn't really get along. Chapter 2, I think I fell in love with you. You said you'd stand by me in the middle of Chapter 3, but you were up to your own tricks in Chapters 5. All right, good afternoon and welcome to Bookmarked. Where today the book under discussion is Wait, What? And Life's Other Essential Questions by James E. Ryan. And my guest, I'm very happy to say, is Lynn Borton. And Lynn, do you want to say hello so I'll know that you're on?
I'm here. Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming. Yeah, this is fine. Lynn is the host of Choose to Be Curious, a radio show which is heard here on KZSM Tuesdays at 10:30 and on some 20 stations, or is it more than that, nationwide?
20 stations around the country.
20 stations, yeah, including the Pacifica Network, which is impressive to me anyway. She worked for many years with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, which is the nation's largest grassroots mental health organization, for 25 years, including 12 as chief operating officer. She describes herself as a facilitator of conversations and transformations. She holds a degree in religious studies from Yale, and I would love to get into that, but I don't know if we'll have time.
I'll come back.
Yeah, good. James E. Ryan is the author of just one book, 5 Miles Away, A World Apart, One City, Two Schools, and the Story of Educational Opportunity in Modern America. And maybe that's one of the longest titles I've ever seen. I guess it was a report on some work he did. He is an American lawyer and a professor. Right now he's president of the University of Virginia. He previously served as the dean of the Harvard Graduate School of Education from 2013 to 2018. And during that time, he gave a commencement address that went viral, and he was persuaded to develop it into this book, which came out in 2017. Before we talk about the book, to give us some context and to introduce you a little more, I want to ask about your show. And how did you happen to start doing a radio show about curiosity?
Well, I mean, you mentioned that I worked at NAMI, and I was the chief operating officer. And basically, if that's your title, your job is to know everything. But I discovered
research.
I was better if I didn't know everything, and I was curious. And so then I thought, well, there must be research about this. I can't be the only person who now thinks, wow, I would be better at my job if I was not a know-it-all, but I was curious. So I made myself a student of the subject. And there was beginning, this is 10 years ago probably, there was beginning to be really interesting research around it. And I thought, I want to keep learning about this. And more importantly, I want to talk to people about this. And luckily, right about that same time, there was a new community radio station launching in Arlington, Virginia, where I live. And they were looking for people to produce shows. And I'd never done radio, but I thought, well, this would be fun. So I got trained and I pitched a show and they said, when do you want to start? And I've been doing it ever since.
Oh, that's wonderful. Now there's something about, I retired and started doing community radio, so I can really empathize with that. How do you find, and I just listened this morning and you had a kind of a reprise of 4 particularly memorable shows, and it was everything from apparently a woman who counsels people to prepare for death, mm-hmm. and a guy who, I don't know, it was something about, it was children's, feeding children and the things that children would and would not eat. I guess perhaps he'd written a book about it, but, you know, there's this wide range of guests. You know, how do you find guests?
It actually is a great episode for sort of the variety that I had. So you mentioned Valoria Walker, who's a death doula, and so she helps people, you know, kind of make that transition to death. And I thought, well, that's a really like, we have a lot of curiosity about death, but a lot of taboo about it.
Yeah.
What would it be like to have a conversation with somebody who grapples with that? And the dad who cooks for his son is actually a social media sensation. He has a TikTok and Instagram feed called Cooking for Levi, which is his 3 or 4 year old son's name. And he has a cookbook out called Cultivating a Curious Palate. And I thought, okay, how is this dad teaching his child to be curious, not just about what he eats, but also kind of in life, and so, you know, sort of throw himself into things? And so, you know, I mean, it's a show all about curiosity. I talk about research and theory, but mostly it's conversations about how curiosity shows up in work and life. And so sometimes there's research that comes out, and I want to talk to the people who do that. Sometimes there are people who have theories about curiosity, and I want to talk to them. But often it's just that there's a concept or there's a person mm-hmm. that seems interesting to me, and I try to find a way to make the conversation about curiosity.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's an audience suggestion. Mm-hmm. People are like, you should talk to my yoga instructor. Mm-hmm. She's always talking about getting curious about what's going on in your body.
Oh.
So I find guests, they find me. I mean, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you must spend a lot
kind
of time.
Delightful.
Yeah, you must spend a lot of time on the internet, though. You know,
I do.
Looking for...
I spend a lot of time prospecting.
Yeah. I can imagine that's a lot of fun. What is the most unusual, I can't resist this, the most unusual show you ever did?
This is a really, I don't know. One guest told me that he thought my show was kind of curiosity and curiosity adjacent. So I take a pretty broad view of what constitutes curiosity. But I would say I did a show on infidelity.
Mm-hmm.
Which I didn't really see coming, but this was one of those funny, I met somebody and I thought, wow, that must be a really interesting conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think the conversation with Valoria on curiosity and death mm-hmm. was one that kind of surprised people. People are always kind of like, oh. Similarly, I did one recently with a retired Army lieutenant on curiosity in combat.
Ooh.
You know, I mean, part of the goal of the show is to understand what we mean by curiosity in the first place. And over time, I've kind of come up with my own sort of working definition that choosing to be curious is acting on the idea that there's opportunity in the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for instance, one of the reasons I like Jim Ryan's book is that it offers us tools for poking into those unknown corners. And so I sort of look for the unexpected conversation. I kind of hope my audiences have a little bit of intellectual whiplash one week to the next.
Yeah.
Like, you never know what's coming.
What are we talking
right?
about
That's
now?
The goal.
Woo-hoo.
Exactly.
This morning show was the timeless wisdom that I mentioned, but what can our listeners expect coming up next for us Tuesday?
I have some good shows coming up next week, actually. It's with a guy named Jason Logan, who is an urban forager and makes his own ink. And he's got a book called Make Ink, but he also came out this fall with a children's book called How to Be a Color Wizard. And it's all about kind of being curious about what you can do with the stuff around you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really fun conversation. I'm excited about that.
I hope an urban forager. Someone told me once that she had a friend or an acquaintance who would never buy food and would only eat things that he found. I hope that's not what your urban forager does.
That's anyway. Well, no. I mean, I don't know that he eats anything that he forages. He makes ink with them. I mean, I do know, and I actually interviewed a woman who is a forager. And she actually supplies Michelin restaurants in New York with, you know, ingredients that she culls from the New Jersey Pine Barrens, where she lives. And again, sort of being curious about, there's a lot of ancient wisdom about the foods that are available to us mm-hmm. that we no longer recognize as foods. And I was interested in, what's it like to get curious about stuff around you to such an extent that you would be willing to eat it and serve it to other people.
You have to see if they're going to try to get you to taste something on the air.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, we're very happy to be broadcasting Choose to be Curious, and it comes up on Tuesday mornings, which is also where when we have our environmental programming in general, something to think about. You suggested in an email that I explain how you wound up on this show, and it was just that I was I was writing my, and I never plug my column on the air, so this is time to do it. I write a column for the San Marcos Daily Record that comes out on Sunday. It is not about this show, except very rarely, but it is, in fact, about KZSM, your true community radio station. So and one of the things I do like to do is feature new shows. When I featured yours, I was rummaging around in your nice website, which I do recommend. It's just choosetobecuriousalloneword.com. And noticed that you had some books that you recommended. So I thought, oh boy, if there's a book she wants to talk about, I can invite her on my show and continue to be curious about her.
I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. Let me summarize the book briefly, kind of, and then we can get into talking about it. It's a relatively short book, expanded, as I said, from this graduation speech. Wait, What? And Life's Other Essential Questions covers five essential questions that he describes as everyday staples of simple and profound conversations alike. Questions that are almost always useful, regardless of context. He devotes a chapter to each question, and he explains and illustrates its effectiveness, talking about a kind of impressive and engaging range of context. I mean, some of them are professional. He's had experience as a clerk in the Supreme Court. Some of them are personal, about his wife or his kids, drawing on his own experience, so he hits a range of things. Is there anything you would add to that as a kind of a summary of the book?
No, I think it's, I put it on my list because it's such an easy, it's like a welcome mat. It's such an easy read and deceptively powerful in terms of curiosity. So I was delighted that we settled on this one.
Yeah. And you want to expand on especially powerful in terms of curiosity?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was one of those people who was infected by the virus of Jim Ryan's 2017 graduation address. It's a little bit, as you mentioned, of a professional hazard because I go looking for inspiration, and commencement speeches can actually be good fodder for these things. But mostly, I think the questions that he poses are actually quite elegant and deceptively simple, mm-hmm. and ultimately quite powerful for those very reasons. And it's a little slip of a book, right? It's really easy to read and absorb. And so it's a little bit of a stealth. Like, you come out the other end of this tiny little book, and suddenly you got like some serious curiosity tools at the ready, and I like that.
Yeah, and they are good questions, and not as simple though as they sound. I was caught by his first paragraph, and I will read it, and then I will tell you why. I didn't warn you that I do like to read from the book under discussion, so that listeners have a feel
from your
for
other shows.
Oh, that's right. I forget you've actually listened to some of my shows, for which I very much appreciate. Introduction. Why do you ask? In case you are wondering, there are really only five essential questions in life. These are the questions you should ask yourself and others on a regular basis. If you get into the habit of asking these five questions, you will live a happier and more successful life. You will also be in a position at the end of the day to give a good answer to what I call the bonus question, which is probably the most important question you will ever face. And the next sentence caught me in exactly what I was about to do, which is, before you roll your eyes, or worse yet, put down this book. Well, I wasn't going to put down the book since I was obligated to talk about it on the show, but it has that introduction, and I hope it's conscious parody, I've done a few self-help books on this show, and I've done enough so that I can kind of see a pattern in them, and I've developed a certain healthy skepticism. Not mm-hmm. that they have bad advice necessarily, but that there will be one kernel of very good advice or one very important observation. Like, for instance, the love languages, mm-hmm. you know, realizing that people perceive the expression of love and express love differently, and this can cause all kinds of confusion and difficulty and pain. That's very, very important. But he builds this whole book and this whole everything around it. So, you know, self-help books tend to say, you know, this one thing will fix your entire life and is the most, you know, is the most important thing, and I get very turned off by that. So he got me good with that. I have to say, he calls it grandiose, but anyway, I mean, have you noticed that about self-help books?
Oh gosh, so true confession, I am not a fan of most self-help books, and I think it would have been really easy for this five-question idea to fall into that trap. I actually have said on more than one occasion that many books were probably once tolerable articles that should have stayed that way.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful that he had the wisdom and the restraint to keep Wait, What? Short. Mm-hmm. And as it is, it's a big expansion on the length of the speech that he gave, but it is mercifully short, and I am grateful for that.
Yeah, I am too. One of the things he does, and this is I had this in the list for a question later, but I think I'll ask it now, because it seems to me that, as I read it, that what he must have done to expand that speech was to come up with these examples, and they're about himself and his background, and it's a way that humanizes him, because another assumption that I made, you know, the publisher makes sure that you see on the cover of the book, Dean of Harvard's Graduate School of Education. I'm like, oh,
right.
You know, well, this is the perhaps the faculty's skepticism about university administrators or something like that. But I'm like, oh, you know, I'm supposed to be impressed by that. But he, you know, and if I think I'm supposed to be impressed, I'm going to resist being so.
Yep.
Yeah. But he talks about himself and his background in ways that humanize him. He tells some funny stories on himself. I thought that, what did you think of his kind of the persona that comes across in here?
I actually think it's really effective. He's actually a very interesting guy.
You've met him?
No, but I've learned a little bit about him over the years because I've been watching him. You know, he was adopted into a working class Catholic family in North Jersey. Goes off to Yale, then off to UVA for law school. He clerks for the Supreme Court Chief Justice, Rehnquist, teaches law, runs the, you know, ed school at Harvard, is now president at UVA. And, you know, I'm here in Virginia. Practically the first thing that happened to him when he got to UVA was the Unite the Right white supremacist rally in Charlottesville.
Oh.
And so he's got these really interesting life stories that I think kind of humanize, and because of the way he's written, and I don't know if he's like this personally, but other things that I've seen him do, he doesn't just humanize, he sort of humorizes, right? He sort of brings some levity, and
yeah.
I think it kind of flips the academic narrative about, you know, erudite and elaborate questions. It's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Is not an erudite question.
Right.
And I think he manages to thread that needle pretty nicely.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. And one other thing that I want to bring up about his introduction, and then we'll need our first break. But he talks about bad questions,
mm-hmm.
and he points out that we need to distinguish between innocent but clumsy questions. And he has a very funny anecdote about one that was asked of him, and actual hostile ones. Is it easy to discriminate, do you think? Or, you know, what did you make of that distinction?
I actually think he's right about that. I don't know. You know, hostility is in the eye of the beholder. But here, I will say this. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, actually, Nigerian novelist, Americana, We Should All Be Feminists, great books. If anybody hasn't read them, I highly recommend them.
Say again.
So this is Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She wrote, she's a Nigerian novelist, lives here in the States. She wrote Americana and We Should All Be Feminists. And they're both, she's written a couple of other books, but those are two that I really liked. And she said somewhere, if you don't understand, ask questions. And if you're not comfortable about asking questions, say you're uncomfortable about asking questions. Mm-hmm. And then ask anyway. It's easy to tell when a question is coming from a good place.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's more often true than we give it credit for being true. And I do think, I interviewed a guy named Scott Shigeoka, wrote a book called Seek, How Curiosity Can Transform Your Life and Change the World, or something like that. And he talks about predatory curiosity, where people are asking questions, and they're not really, like, they want to make a point. They're not really wanting to understand better. Yeah. They're wanting to make a point. And when you're on the receiving end of that, you can tell the difference.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually, it's a useful thing to keep in mind. Mm-hmm. That sometimes curiosity is not enough. We ask questions in ways that are unkind and unthoughtful, and the way we do it really matters.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think you can recognize those. As we talked, I recalled, of course, academic conferences, and the question, somebody asking a question intended more to show off their erudition than to actually learn more about what the speaker was saying, you know.
And question.
Yeah.
You know, I'm smarter than you are.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or
oh, yeah.
I know about things that the rest of you in this room do not know. You know.
Right.
All right. Okay. As warned, we are, one more button, we are up on our next break.
Choose to Be Curious is a show all about curiosity. We talk about research and theory, but mostly it's conversations about how curiosity shows up in work and life.
I think curiosity is the basis of life.
I'm your host, Lynn Borton. I hope you'll join me Tuesday mornings at 10:30, right here on KZSM 104.1 FM, San Marcos. Come, choose to be curious.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Whitliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Whitliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Whitliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
All right, welcome back to Bookmarked, where we are talking about Wait, What? And Life's Other Essential Questions by James Bryan. And we are talking about it with, I'm very happy to say, Lynn Borton, who is the host of Choose to Be Curious, which is heard here on KZSM on Tuesdays at 10:30. There's five essential questions and a bonus question. And the first one is the title question, Wait, What? Why would someone call me now? That's something to be curious about, I guess. Is the title question, Wait, What? And he points out that the wait part is what makes the question distinctive, or it's the wait he says, that precedes the what could be seen as just a useless rhetorical tick. But I think it's crucial because it reminds you and others to slow down to make sure you truly understand. Too often we fail to pause for clarification, thinking that we understand something before we do. In doing so, we miss the opportunity to grasp the full significance of an idea, an assertion, or an event. Asking, wait, what, is a good way to capture rather than miss these opportunities. So, would you agree that the wait is important?
I do. I do. I think a pause is really important. And that's sort of the wait, what?
Kind yeah.
of, you know, you stumble, you slow down, you break your stride. And you can almost see somebody sort of turning around to pay more attention to something. And I think it's that stumble. It's that break in our purposeful stride that opens the door for the curiosity, for the what, for the question, for the observation that that was not what I expected. Like, wait, okay, you just surprised me.
Yeah.
And I think that's its value. And, you know, he has a funny take about how differently it lands depending on how we say it. Like the, wait, what?
Yeah.
Is really different than the, wait, what?
Yeah.
And in both cases, they modify one another in really important and telling ways, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they do indeed. He says one of the advantages of wait, what is, or at least in his example, somebody gets the full personal story. And that's where you have to be careful in the kind of the kind of question that you ask. I think another advantage. Sorry, I got momentarily distracted. Part of the joys of doing your own production is momentary distractions. Another advantage he talks about with saying wait, what, is to avoid jumping to conclusions. And I'm going to see what he says about that. It's easy, too easy, to simply to react, often passionately and often based on assumptions rather than facts. Reminding yourself to ask, wait, what, is a way to guard against jumping too quickly to conclusions. And I think that's certainly true. But it's a little difficult. I mean, don't you think we're programmed to make sure that discourse goes very smoothly and we don't want to interrupt and we don't want to break the flow. So one might hesitate a little bit to do that wait what, don't you think?
I mean, I think it's an interesting question about, you know, sort of checking ourselves on our assumptions.
Yeah.
And not jumping to conclusions. I mean, I think that's the work of life, actually. And one reason I like his questions are that they're sort of like a personal checklist for doing just that. You know, if we add a little more wait what into our days and our thinking for ourselves, not just about other people, but about ourselves as well, I think we'd be the better for it.
I absolutely agree. And he also does point out that it can help other people clarify their thinking by being asked, wait, what? Then, you know, the other person maybe thinks through a little more. You ask a lot of questions on do you ever have to deal with your own assumptions about the subjects you discuss? I mean, do you find yourself doing as you prepare your shows?
Yeah, well, I'm sure you have this experience too, where you go into a book or a conversation and you have an idea about what that conversation is going to be like, and then you spend some time thinking about it. And you realize, oh, I made some assumptions here. Maybe those aren't the best assumptions. So there's an opportunity to sort of catch yourself before you're in the conversation.
Yeah.
But to me, it's also like it's an opportunity rather than thinking of it as an obstacle or a barrier to good conversation. You know, what if we instead we thought of it as an opportunity in the conversation? And that, I think, takes some practice. I am guilty of jumping to conclusions and having assumptions as much as anybody else. And so I do try to, you know, I try to practice what I preach. I try to use these tools to put speed bumps in my way. Mm-hmm. Because if you have speed bumps, you're less likely to just go barreling right through all of your assumptions.
Yeah, exactly. Question two is really, it's really two questions, and it's sort of not a question. It's, I wonder, and he says, it's, I wonder why, and I wonder if. And he makes a comment, and I'm being somewhat older myself, I wonder if this is why or whether this is true of me. He says, for whatever reason, most people I have noticed tend to become less curious about the world as they age. And I think there are some things that I'm less curious about. There are faces of celebrities that appear in the newspaper or on social media, and I don't even know who they are. And I'm not particularly curious about who they are, whereas, you know, when I was younger, I would have known who the well-known actress or performer was, or, you know, I would have maybe even been curious about their lives. But now it's just, oh, okay. So I don't know. Do you think we lose valuable curiosity as we grow older,
So first I want to say, I think there's a lot more than two questions here. I mean, there's I wonder why, I wonder if, but there's also I wonder how, I wonder who, mm-hmm. I wonder which. I mean, to me, the important thing is to wonder, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So there are lots of theories about why or even whether we lose our sense of wonder with age. You know, some of the theories are it's sort of pushed out by other obligations or expectations. I actually had a really interesting conversation about a year ago with a woman named Michiko Sakaki, who studies curiosity and aging, and she did this surveying of people, and her respondents believed that they were less curious by definition, her older respondents, mm-hmm. but the research showed otherwise. And so that was really interesting to her, that they've sort of bought the idea that they're not as curious as they used to be, but the evidence of their interest and their, you know, their passions and their pursuits suggests otherwise. And I think it is true that the kinds of things that we wonder about change over time.
Yeah.
But I think it's worth pushing back against the very common narrative that we don't wonder as much. You know, sort of my purpose in life is to get people to decide, oh, maybe that's something I could wonder about, you know, to find the opportunities to choose to be curious, to choose to wonder about things in the course of the day. I just think it's more interesting, a more interesting way to live one's life. But also, I actually think it's really important for our social fabric and our relationships that we do that. Really good advice.
Because in being curious and about other people and trying to satisfy our curiosity, we engage with them in maybe productive ways.
And there's really strong research that says that people who are more engaged and have more relationships, meaningful relationships with people, live longer and healthier lives. It's really good for well-being to be engaged, and one way to be engaged is to be just a little bit curious, to just wonder a little bit.
Yeah. I liked your observation that I wonder why and I wonder if didn't completely cover it. Do you think he should have included some of those other things, or did he kind of fold them in?
We were grateful for the fact that this is a short book, right?
Yeah,
we could have
gone
much wider, but I think for his purposes, actually, I wonder why and I wonder if are kind of those are the top level ones.
Yeah,
because they're the generative ones in some ways. You know, I wonder how, wonder who, wonder what. Those get to be,
a little narrower, more specific.
Yeah. But I wonder why. That's a really important question to ask. And then I wonder if is this sort of why looks back, if looks forward. What might I be able to do about it is the unspoken thing there. And that's his point, right? That's what he wants you.
Yeah.
What he wants us to be thinking about.
Yeah. The question, I wonder if, is a question worth asking on its own. It's also closely connected with I wonder why. Once you start asking, I wonder why, and especially if you get an unsatisfying answer, you are inevitably going to ask, I wonder if things could be different. Put another way, to ask, I wonder why, about the present naturally raises the question, I wonder if, about the future. And I like the way he sort of subtly incorporates, he doesn't really talk about politics or political action directly, but in talking about I wonder if, he kind of talks about a process that could move someone to change something or to try to make it better, and some of his examples cover that. I also like the way there's that aspect of life that gets covered by these questions, but then there's also the more personal as well. So you could ask the questions about the larger world and maybe even be led to some sort of action or interaction yourself, or you could ask them about yourself. I wonder if I. I thought that I liked that, and he had a. I don't know if I have this. Oh yeah, I wonder if just because we've talked about his being funny and haven't done any examples. I'll read the passage where he applies this, that question, talks about how he applied that kind of question to himself. I wondered if I could row crew in college. No, I was too short, as you might remember. I wondered if I could join an a cappella group. No, because it turns out you need to be able to sing. I wondered if I could play rugby instead. Yes, as height and singing ability didn't matter much. I wondered if I could support myself for 6 months after college in Australia by working as a garbage collector. Not really. Once I found a dead cat in a garbage can, I was done. I wondered if I could bungee jump. Yes, but never again. I wondered if I could learn to play ice hockey as an adult. Not well, according to my kids and my teammates. I wondered if I could learn how to juggle. Yes, because it's not exactly actually that hard. I wondered 5 years ago if I could learn to surf. Sort of, is the answer my kids would give. I wondered if I could learn to play the piano. No, unless Mary Had a Little Lamb counts if you don't. It doesn't if you ask Katie, that's his wife. I like that. I think I read it just kind of for the fun of it in some ways.
Well, I think I'm glad you did, because I think it does give you a sense of kind of the feel of the book, right?
Yeah.
If you go by the written by the dean of Harvard's Graduate School of Education, you have one idea of this book. If you go by that paragraph, you have a really different idea of it. And to our point about, you know, challenging assumptions, I think that's a good one. But I think he's very successful in making the global personal and vice versa. I think that's actually the mark of a strong educator. One reason I think that his personal stories are important is that they kind of serve as role models. That self-deprecation is a pretty effective device to neutralize the preachiness that can sometimes come with, you know, all of this. So I think those are lovely examples of different ways that we can ask these questions of ourselves. They don't have to always be heavy, right?
Right.
They might be, but they don't have to be.
Yeah. I liked what you said about the moving between the kind of the global and the personal. Of course, that's what really good fiction does, you know, when you think about
absolutely.
It. Yeah. Okay, well, we can we can trying to decide whether to start on question three or go ahead and get through another break. I guess I will go. We will go ahead and get through another break.
On the radio, this is the Sweet Honey Bear Blues on Tuesday at 8 o'clock till 10 o'clock. You got me giving you what you just didn't know you needed.
Bookmarked is brought to you in part by the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. San Antonio has inspired generations of writers, musicians, and artists. Now, the city's creative currents are highlighted in a new exhibition at the Whitliff Collections. Spirit of San Antonio, drawn from the Whitliff's vast archival holdings, explores the city through many of its leading creative talents, including writers Sandra Cisneros, Rick Riordan, Carmen Tafoya, Naomi Shihab Nye, and many more. Also featured in the exhibition are selections from the extraordinary Ramon Hernandez Tejano Music Collection at the Whitliff, which includes treasured photographs and recordings from Tejano legends Selena, Flaco Jimenez, Sonny Ozuna, Steve Jordan, and more. Rounding out the exhibition are captivating images from celebrated photographers and artists weaving an unforgettable group portrait of this fascinating American city. On display now at the Whitliff Collections at Texas State University. For more information, please visit thewhitliffcollections.txstate.edu.
All right, welcome back to Bookmarked, where we're talking about James E. Ryan's book, Wait, What? And Life's Other Essential Questions. And we are talking about it with Lynn Borton, who recommends this book on her website. She is the host of Choose to Be Curious. And we've been kind of looking at each of the questions. Question three, which I really like, is, couldn't we at least? And that has to do with projects, activity. When I was making notes, I had remembered it as couldn't we just, but couldn't we at least seems better in a way, because it's less, couldn't we just suggest a certain kind of impatience, you know, well, come on, let's just get on with it. What's the matter with you? But couldn't we at least is a good deal more sort of modest, I think, and somewhat less demanding. I don't know. Am I overthinking this?
Well, I don't know. I think just is always kind of a tricky word. To begin with, I mean, we talk about people being just curious, and it's never just curious. But I think at least suggests that there's a potential for more. I think it has this kind of invitation to continuation, if you will. But I do also think it's got a little bit of guilt built into it. Like, couldn't we at least do this? Like, really? You're not going to let, at least we can work on this thing? And I think that's,
yeah,
I think it is better than just, as you say, because it's not too much, but it's like, oh, come on. We can do something here.
Yeah.
You know, let's find it. I like that. I like the opportunity that it suggests.
Yeah. He offers this as an antidote to what he calls group polarization, which I've read and heard about and talked about on this show, and I bet you have on yours as well.
Oh, yeah.
Studies of social media, he says, Facebook in particular, show that we are creating virtual gated communities where those with like-minded views only share information that confirms their beliefs. Traditional media, meanwhile, increasingly cater to segments of the population. Conservatives watch Fox News, liberals watch MSNBC. This is an unfortunate and dangerous because of a phenomenon social scientists call group polarization. And I had not thought of this so much. When like-minded individuals get together online or in real life, they tend to reinforce each other's views. They not only increase the strength of each other's convictions, but they often lead each other, intentionally or not, to take even more extreme positions. Oh, isn't he terrible? Oh, I think he's even terribler than you do. which is kind of what he's talking about. And I guess that happens. You know.
It does. And there's a lot of research around that, actually. I mean, yes, I think in curiosity is a huge contemporary problem. It's part of the reason I do my show.
Mm-hmm.
You have to keep the conversation going. If you're looking for another good book, I can recommend Monica Guzman wrote, I Never Thought of It That Way, How to Have Fearlessly Curious Conversations in Dangerously Divided Times. And, you know, mm-hmm. self-help alert, it is a little in that category. But this is a book about how to get away from group polarization. And, you know, she says things like, you know, be one level more curious about people who disagree with you instead of putting all of your energy into sort of digging in your position, which is what most of us do, to try to find those opportunities to go, let me ask another question.
Couldn't we at least agree as a way to push back against polarization and extremism, because it is an invitation to find some areas of consensus. If you can find some common ground with others, you are likely, especially those with different views, you are likely to see the world as a more nuanced place. And I like that. And again, he talks about, I don't know, he's finding, it seems to me that finding common ground is maybe not as easy as he makes it sound, however, you know. Yeah. Have you ever had trouble finding common ground with anybody you interviewed? Or I suppose if you vetted them first, maybe, you know.
Well, I don't vet my guests. I don't talk to them ahead of time, so I don't necessarily know where the conversation is going. But I do think that just starting with the assumption of common ground actually helps. You know, they say there's more that unites us than divides us. And I actually think that's true.
I hope so, anyway.
Right. I mean, I do think, you know, as Monica Guzman would say, it isn't easy, but it's important anyway. So just, you know, tough it up, take little steps, get used to it.
Yeah.
It's worth it. You know, it's okay if it's hard. That's what I used to say to my kids. It's okay if it's hard.
But it's hard, Mom. Oh, you
know. Good. Yeah. Good. That's how you know you're working.
All right. He also starts, talks about, couldn't we at least, as a way to sort of make a start on something, you know, which I really liked. Couldn't we at least, you're essentially suggesting that you and others can do something, get started on something. And he talks about, you know, I believe that what we don't do often haunts us more than what we actually do. And he references, we didn't have a chance to talk about that, but one of his introduction talks about a couple of previous graduation addresses that he gave that were less successful. He's pretty funny about the first one, actually. But one of them is about the sin of omission, which seems to kind of interest him, maybe part of his Catholic upbringing. I don't know.
I warned
you about that.
I know. I feel like I'm right there.
Yeah. Well, but it's valuable to make a start. Anything else occur to you about couldn't we at least?
Well, I mean, I think regret is real, right? Mm. And it, you know, it often is the things that we don't do that we regret the most. Yeah. And we have a lot of curiosity about that, like about possible alternative outcomes and what might have happened and what ifs. And I think that's information for us about our interest in understanding what the choices are that we make and how we might have chosen differently. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Question four, how can I help? And this, I really liked this one too. The form of the question is really important here. What is important is that, as he explains, and I certainly know that, is the how. All of which is to say that how you help matters just as much as that you do help, which is why it is essential to begin by asking, how can I help? If you start with this question, you are asking with humility for direction. You are recognizing that others are experts in their own lives, and you are affording them the opportunity to remain in charge, even if you are providing some help. And does that, you had a lot of experience with a helping agency, so I guess
I think you're right. I think asking in that way empowers others. You don't come in as omniscient, omnipotent, any of those things. You're coming in like, how you tell me how I can be helpful. And when I first had kids in school, and I would sort of go to the PTA president, I'm like, how can I be helpful? And she's like, oh my gosh, I love that you ask that. As opposed to kind of coming in like, here's what I'm going to do, out of my way.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize how helpful that was for me to be saying that until I was, years later, the PTA president. And I'm like, wow, how about you ask what's needed as opposed to making assumptions, right? Yeah. And this is one of those places I just really admire his economy of words with his questions, right? I mean, this is a really simple, really direct, really respectful way of coming into any conversation.
Yeah, yeah, I would absolutely agree. Did you run into what he calls the savior complex, or
when you're in your
work with the you give it the initials, but I've got the
NAMI,
the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I mean, that sounds like a place that would be where you would really need how can I help all the time.
Yes, and it was an interesting tension within the organization, actually, because the organization was founded by the families of people with serious mental illnesses. And over time, as treatment modalities and sort of the prognosis for people really improved and changed, the organization had to really shift to center the experience of the person with the mental illness or had the lived experience. And not make assumptions about, well, I'm a parent, I know how to do this, but really to change that dialogue to, how can I be helpful? Like, I'm not living this. I'm living my experience of it. I'm not living your experience of it. How can I be helpful to you?
Yeah.
And that was a really important change within the organization. So, I mean, to your point, like, the how is really important. It changes the conversation completely.
Yeah. Asking how you can help, he says, is an effective way of nudging others to identify, express, and confront their own problems. Mm-hmm. So you don't, if they've already thought it through, you're giving them space. But maybe if they haven't, then they can think about, what is it that I really need? And he has, he says, this is understandably hard to do, as Atul Gawande describes movingly in Being Mortal, when he recounts the difficult choices advanced cancer patients must make about their own care, that he wishes that doctors would ask them how they could help. And I mentioned this as kind of a plug for next week's show, in which Rebecca Bell-Medero and I will be talking about this very book, Atul Gawande's Being Mortal. And I'm looking forward, particularly since I talked to you about it earlier, I'm looking forward to reading it.
I think you're going to have a great conversation.
Yeah. I can think of times when I wish someone had asked that question of me instead of, particularly when I was young, when I was growing up, instead of saying, well, this is what I'm going to do for you. Oh, okay.
Right. I think we can all think of those times.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And times probably when I should have asked it as well. Yeah. We've got 6 minutes. Question five, what truly matters? He talks about how asking this question helps you focus on what you're doing and how easy it is. And he certainly explains that eloquently, I think, how very easy it is to get caught up in, details. We may be too caught in routine to pay attention. We may lack confidence in our abilities and focus on largely irrelevant details rather than confront the difficult and challenging work in front of us. We may become so stressed that we become easily distracted or have trouble focusing. In each of these situations, it is useful to ask yourself what truly matters. And I certainly think people do that all the time. His examples are here are particularly funny because he talks about his wife is in labor, and first he looks for cheap parking at the hospital, and then he's confronted with this inexperienced medical resident, and she is really, he says, he looked to the nurse and began to list everything he might need for the delivery. "I'll need my safety glasses," he said, as the nurse looked skeptically back at him. "I'll need my booties," meaning those blue and green cloth covers that go over shoes, "and I'll need some water to drink." At this point, the nurse looked over me with a raised eyebrow, which prompted me to suggest gently, "Doctor, I think we need to focus here a bit. Katie is about to burst." And that was a particularly good example of the irrelevant detail. And I think it's astute of him to point out that when we do that, often we do that when we're unsure of ourselves. You think that's true?
I do. And I think I really appreciate some of his examples because they're so relatable, right? We've all been in that position where it's like there's a big thing to be dealt with and we're caught up with the minutiae. And it's kind of a paralysis, right? And I think that, it is, it's a great way. I use it all the time now. I'm like, wait, what really matters here?
Okay.
You know, it's a great way to kind of like, okay, clear the detritus, you know, clear the distractions.
He does talk about what truly matters in the course of a lifetime. And he comes up with these kind of familiar elements, family, friends, work and acts of kindness. I liked that, but it seemed a little less thought provoking, perhaps, or a little more expected. That's probably not grammatical, but and a lot of this book is not always what I expected, which I like. But then he goes on to ask kind of what matters about these things in family, friends, work, and acts of kindness, I mean, in an individual existence, and also to talk about balance among them. And there I thought, you know, that was kind of up to the level of what he'd been doing through most of the book.
Right, and he talks about doing this at New Year's, which seems very timely, you know, given this, but he also said something about, like, I will fall short, which is one of the reasons I continue to ask the questions. And I think that's... that to me is sort of his signature line, right? It's this kind of humility that our lives are improved by asking ourselves these kinds of questions and asking these questions of the people around us.
Exactly. Okay, yeah. I think we'll say that listeners have to read the book to find out what the bonus question is.
Oh, there you go.
And you tell me about the big jar of wannabe analogies in the next 2 minutes because I am curious about it.
Okay, so at the end of my show, I invite my guests to join me when I call my big jar of wannabe analogies, which is a literal jar. It's filled with slips of paper. And I take out a slip for my guest, a slip for me, and a slip for the audience. And we make an analogy to curiosity with whatever is on that slip of paper. So, for instance, yours is dog walking. How is curiosity like dog walking? And mine is thermos. How is curiosity like a thermos? Would you like me to model before you try yours?
I think, besides, thermos is a lot harder than dog walking.
So how is curiosity like a thermos? I think a thermos is a way to carry something sustaining with you to a place that it might not otherwise be. And I think curiosity can do that for us. I think thermoses keep things hot. And I think curiosity can keep things hot. When I was a kid, I really loved my thermos. I just thought it was kind of cool. And I guess nothing's changed because I think curiosity is pretty cool too.
Oh,
so that's how curiosity is like a thermos. So how is curiosity like dog walking?
Well, dog walking takes you places it may take you even into a familiar place, but it will take you someplace that you didn't expect, because your dog, who is always curious about a whole network of smells and sensations that you're not even aware of. So curiosity is like dog walking, because it will take you to unexpected places and lead you to unexpected observations. I told you that one was easier.
See, well, there you go. Okay. And listeners, yours is pumpernickel bread. How is curiosity like pumpernickel bread?
Oh, if anybody's listening, text me after the show and tell me. All right. Lynn Borton, host of Choose to Be Curious, Tuesdays at 10:30 on KZSM. Thank you so much for calling in from Arlington, Virginia, and talking to me about this. And you mentioned another book, so I think we will do this again. And after a while, with the book that you were talking about.
Great!
All right. So thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
And as always, thank you for listening.